the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 241. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is one P. Andrew S. No, P. Andrew Esquire Torres is what I was going to say, but that would be wrong. P. Andrew Torres Esquire, how are you doing?
I was great until you botched my name like that, but no, I'll recover. I mean, you know, we've only done this together for 2.5 years. Why would you know my name?
Such a lawyer to me that I forgot whether or not the Esquire was in your name, like you were named, destined. Or whether,
you know, yeah. if you're trying to get back into my good graces, the phrase "you're such a lawyer to me" is probably not the way to go. No, I'm fantastic. How are you? The happy first show of the new year.
Oh yeah, that's true. Jeez, I got to write 2019 on my podcast.
2019 on all my podcasts.
Yeah. I am excited to be back. You know what I'm also excited for is the amazing bonus stuff over on patreon.com/law. We just did Lot Awful Movies that was hilarious, and it was a ton of fun. It was the Boston Legal pilot episode, and my brother Sam joined us from Comedy Shoeshine, and it was it helps when you get another person to make fun of stuff. It was fun. That's a bad show, I'm going to say. That's a bad.
Yeah, if you consider inflicting pain on us to be fun, then that was a fun Lot Awful Movies.
That was a bad show.
I love William Shatner. There was so much that I really wanted
great
to like
acting.
About. Yeah, anyway, well.
The whole cast is good. It's, well, go listen and find out. I think I did a teaser because I think you folks will be shocked. Lawyers could not believe. How do I write a clickbaity headline for this? Opening Arguments listeners could not believe when Opening Arguments ranked the law in this episode. I think you'll be shocked. So go check that out. And of course, thanks to everyone who came out for the live Q&A. That was just a couple days ago. That was a ton of fun. Of course, patrons can find the audio in their feed and. But in the future, check out the YouTube, hop on over. It's open to everybody and we'll announce it when the next one's going to be. So that's all the housekeeping stuff I can think of. All right. I think that's all I've got in terms of stuff. I was just so excited about that bonus stuff and I hope everybody enjoyed it. So what do you think? Anything before we get going, Andrew?
If that is your name.
Political. Political. Let's get into political.
All right, Stephen, here we go. John, Robert, here we go. I don't know. No.
I like how you went with all first names of Supreme Court justices. Well,
that's
there.
True.
I hope that was.
You know, they say psychologically. I've read some books. Your brain gets primed for the language you're going to use. You know, it might be no coincidence. All right, let's get on with it. I am excited to hear the update. Not the cheeriest of topics, but we had talked about that PG&E and the wildfires kind of report. We'd done a little bit of speculating as to what could have happened there. So we're gonna find out the real story, hopefully. And also, oh my gosh, I can't believe we didn't lead off with this. Hey, Democrats are in control of the House right now.
Yeah, Today is, we may call the episode this, today is Oversight Day. Nancy Pelosi was sworn in as Speaker of the House, and there are some really interesting developments for Yodel Mountain that are related to that.
Oh, wow.
So I thought we might kind of quickly go through it. The first thing that I wanted to bring your attention to, I don't know if you saw this, there was a tremendous interview of Nancy Pelosi by Savannah Guthrie on NBC. And the topic that is sort of getting the most headlines, you know, an hour before we record, because that's the way life works, was the question that Savannah Guthrie asked regarding whether she intended to follow the OLC, that is the Office of Legal Counsel's memo issued in 2000 that says you cannot indict a sitting president. And I want to draw, I gave her a shout out on Twitter. This is really, really excellent questioning by Savannah Guthrie, who is a lawyer, has a law degree. And you can see, you know, really kind of lawyerly questioning, right? So she asked, do you think that, you know, that you're going to follow the 2000 guideline? And then Nancy Pelosi says, I don't think that's conclusive. Right.
Right.
I do not. That's a fair answer. Yeah. Savannah Guthrie asks a follow up. She says, but could Robert Mueller indict a sitting president? And then Pelosi kind of dodges again and says, not dodges, but, you know, tries to give a noncommittal answer, says, everything indicates that a president can be indicted after he is no longer president of the United States. And then Guthrie asks, well, what about a sitting president? And then Nancy Pelosi says, well, a sitting president when he is no longer president of the United States. So then she asks again, yes, but what about a president who's in office? Could Robert Mueller come back and say, I am seeking an indictment? And Nancy Pelosi says, I think that is an open discussion. I think it's an open discussion in terms of the law. We have to wait to see what happens with the Mueller report. So I put that in kind of the larger category. I think it's a really good illustration. We try and call out when folks ask good questions in such a way that pin down their listeners. I've called out Kamala Harris for doing this before. I think she's outstanding at it. Former Senator Al Franken was very good at this. But I think that this really signifies sort of where we are in ascending Yodel Mountain, right? That Nancy Pelosi was criticized, including by you and I, Thomas, kind of right after the midterm elections, you know, for saying, for being kind of noncommittal about the Mueller investigation and about impeaching Trump. And
I don't care about that. I don't think that was me. That was more you.
Oh.
I think she's just saying what people lost their S about that, but I don't. I think she's just being political. I didn't really care that much about what her saying.
No, I agree. I mean, I think let me be accurate then. I think we both think that she sort of twists in the wind a little bit, and I think that this is an illustration that the winds have blown in the past 2 months, and so I think it's fair to interpret it that way. I also want to share, I'll link it up in the show notes, really, really good thread by Paul Krugman on Twitter. Paul Krugman, liberal theorist and unquestionably brilliant economist. He wrote the econ textbook that I used to teach my son economics. and he goes through and he illustrates the lack of mathematical support for the notion that Nancy Pelosi is a controversial Speaker of the House.
Right.
And contrast it with the fact that Paul Ryan is leaving with a 12% approval rating.
Yeah.
12% is below Ebola and just above Dick Cheney, right? Like, I mean, that's where that rests, right? Like,
Ebola is higher.
Yes, yeah, it is. Ebola, Paul Ryan, Dick Cheney, and then, you know.
I mean, if I had to be afflicted with one of those three things, I guess Ebola would be the first thing I would choose. Good point. Yeah.
I thought it was a good read. I'm going to add that in
there. Well, that's interesting. I wasn't planning on doing this, but I just listened to The Daily, and I kind of want to give the opposite plug, which is I'm annoyed with Barbaro was interviewing Chuck Schumer and just grilling him, and it just on things that didn't really make any sense to me. So the opposite. I don't like that. We'll plug a good interview and a bad. To me, it was like you've got a president who is sitting in a pile of his own feces and he's chanting wall, wall, wall. And even though despite the fact that, by the way, I seem to remember something about Mexico paying for it. I know. Ooh, if only we could run back 74 hours of consecutive tape of someone saying, and Mexico will pay for it, and Mexico will pay for it, and Mexico. So that's the facts. And then you've also got him, in addition to chanting wall over and over, which, by the way, I think Trump is sitting while he's doing this because he thinks that's what being a sitting president means, and he can't. It's like base. Like, you can't get me when I'm the sitting president. And then he's also
president. That's good.
He's also chanting stuff about Mexican hordes like coming over through the porous border, which isn't real. And so the New York Times is like, well, we can't interview that. Like that's not anything. So what we'll do is we'll interview the only adult around and we'll treat him like a hostile person. Like we'll just because we can't be biased. So and they're just grilling Schumer over and over. The interview should have just been, so how about the president who said Mexico would pay for the wall and now is shutting down the whole government over it? Yep. That sucks. Okay. End of interview. There's nothing. He was like trying to get him. Should you give him the wall? Do you think you should give him? So you're not going to give him the wall. Well, what about maybe giving him part of it? It's just what? Come on. We don't need a fake neutrality. So tired of it.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I recently read a Law Review article that suggests that the entire strategy of the Trump White House has been to deliberately disintermediate the press, right? To make himself so uninterviewable, right? So non-responsive that it, exactly that, that then he can go on to Twitter, right? And mobilize his, you know, 30 million army strong of morons. And he can say to the press, I don't need you in a way that no president has ever been able
it's
to do that.
It's true. It's
and
working.
Of course, he's backed by Fox News. Right?
Yeah. But, yeah. So hard to argue with it. And we don't know how to deal with it. We're not equipped.
Yeah.
We're not equipped to have a feral animal in the White House that you're like, well, you can't. There's like a raccoon or something. Just throwing cans around. You're like, well, okay, we'll interview Chuck Schumer, I guess. I don't know. All right, sorry. You brought a good interview. I thought it was a bad interview for me.
That's a
personally.
Good sidebar.
Yeah.
So let me add on. With today being Oversight Day, two really really interesting pieces of information to kind of go into the puzzle. Right. The first is that the House of Representatives begins 2019. We have the government shutdown over the wall that you just alluded to, but the House of Representatives still has funding. I was looking for this, right? How did Nancy Pelosi get sworn in today? House funding was approved August 1st, 2018. Mm. And I discovered in that appropriations bill, I really have no idea how this happened, that the appropriations bill passed by the Congress gives the House operations an additional $129 million in funding for 2019. Okay, that is up about 8% from the fiscal year 2018. Operations are funds that can be used on staff, right? On hiring, in particular, say outside lawyers.
Huh.
And I don't know. Why a Republican Congress would do this and why a Republican president would sign off on it. But your Democratic-controlled House of Representatives will be almost 10% stronger in terms of being able to conduct investigation and oversight.
That is interesting. What was the date you said on that? Was it before? Like, did they think they were going to win the midterms?
Maybe they thought they were going to win the midterms. It was August 1st. Okay. And maybe there was a tremendous amount of overconfidence.
I certainly had some MAGA heads insisting on my Twitter that it was all a liberal bubble, the idea that we were going to win the House. So could be. Yeah. Could be they thought
they
were
put their
win.
Money where their mouth is to the tune of $129 million.
Oh, we won that wager, you're saying.
Yeah.
Cool.
And relatedly, There is. I will upload the Axios article and maybe a copy of the job posting. Republicans, the Republican House of Representatives, just posted a job request for a counsel that they are seeking an investigative counsel, quote, an attorney with several years of investigative or litigation experience, right, end quote. That is the House Judiciary Committee posting on a prominent Washington, D.C. Job site.
Print out my resume. I'm in. Brian, put my bar score. Oh, maybe we can have the Wiki people. Okay. Wiki people, put my bar score on my resume. Let's get it looking good, and I'm going to apply for this position.
Yeah. Axios says that they have a source that says that the request for litigation experience, quote, is at least partly in anticipation of the possibility of impeachment proceedings.
Wow.
End of quote. So there you go. Keep your eye out. Yeah. Definitely, Thomas, you should apply for that job. And so I'm, you know, seriously,
I'm more qualified than who they put up for judge nominations. So from time to time. OK, you just got to test me on my vocab. What is emotion in limine? As long as I can answer that, then I think I'm more qualified than most of who they would have. That's interesting. So, wow, this is not just you're not putting this down to like far left conspiracy theory stuff. You think maybe some rumblings, maybe some movings and doings on the impeachment front.
I think I look at those things and they certainly seem consistent. And again, you know, I would not, I do not want to overplay them in any way whatsoever. But I kind of put all of that together and, you know, we will continue our trek and continue to yodel in 2019.
Yeah. Awesome. Any other yodeling? I know you had predicted, since it's Oversight Day, everybody get out all your Oversight Day decorations. I know you'd kind of predicted that we would end up or somebody would end up with Trump's tax returns pretty quickly. How are you feeling about that prediction? When should we look for that?
I feel very, very strongly all about right. that prediction. And I would say I will do an Andrew was wrong if they are not leaked within the month. The House Committee on Taxation has the legal power to subpoena Trump's tax returns from the IRS. I cannot believe that Trump would obstruct the IRS in complying with a lawful subpoena. And once they're in the possession of the House, then they will be able to read them into the record as part of the deliberative privilege. So I think we're going to get that.
All right.
And hold me accountable.
I want to pin you down on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, speaking of,
I mean, not today, not on day
one.
But we're going to get it.
Speaking of, I just had a quick Thomas was wrong. I remember I needed to do this segment. I had said in a previous episode that there are only hardcore Bruce Springsteen fans or that's it. Like you had agreed. So let's make this Andrew was wrong. and then we had our listeners in the group put up a poll in which like they all said they're casual Springsteen fans. So there's a few who said hardcore, but hey, all right. If the data is going to prove me wrong, I got to admit I'm wrong. It must just be that you hear, you know, this squeaky wheel kind of thing or whatever, where you only notice the hardcore ones, I guess. So maybe that's my fault. I was wrong. You know, I fell victim to a classic
new tagline, opening arguments, the home of casual Bruce Springsteen
yeah.
fans.
Turns out we're just a whole nest of casual Bruce Springsteen fans.
Because I have to say, I mean, I nodded along with you with the with that characterization, but I kind of would put myself into that category, right? Like, I like Hungry Heart, you know.
I don't think the show ever would have happened if you were a hardcore Bruce Springsteen fan, because it's the first thing out of anyone's mouth, you know, like you're instantly talking about Bruce Springsteen. Oh, he's so great. And it's like, I don't know. Okay. All right. I was wrong. And Andrew was too, because he agreed with me.
Yeah.
Which is the
important God,
thing.
I'm going down with this sinking ship. So.
Okay. So this is all Oversight Day. Is there anything else?
No, that's it.
Awesome. I'm so excited. And you know, I was just going to say a quick thing about Pelosi and the impeachment stuff. My interpretation was, and I want to see if you, what you think about this. I think because the House oversight has been, well, all of congressional oversight in this case, pretty much, has been so just absent, so broken, so nothing in the age of Trump, that I think the strategy is, we can't just say, you know, Democrats leadership can't just say, impeachment. They're trying to start from like a, you know, an allegedly kind of neutral. All right, we're going to start investigating. It's like the police arriving and saying, we're going to get that guy right there. And it's like, well, hold on, you gotta do an investigation first. You know, I think they're trying to go for that sort of image. Like, okay, we're going to investigate, get our facts. We all know there's plenty of impeachment stuff, like grounds for impeachment out there. But I think that's what they're trying to do. And it's why I didn't really, in my opinion, it's why I didn't freak out about it. Like, people were really mad at Pelosi for suggesting like that might not be, we're not going to talk impeachment yet. It's like, yeah, they're going to do oversight and investigate first. And then they won't, they're trying to prevent against the Republican attack of, oh, you just said you wanted impeachment and then you found whatever it was going to lead you to that, you know? So that's what I thought of that. How do you feel as an explanation?
I agree 100% with that. And I would add, right, that is consistent with the ethos, the mindset, and the implementation by Robert Mueller, right? It's what we've been saying from the beginning, right? Get all the information, proceed methodically, make a case that is ironclad, because, I totally agree with you that, you know, look, we know what the fight is going to look like, and the only questions in my mind are, number one, will facts matter? And number two, how unassailable are those facts?
And then number three, I guess, will be like, will they want to just run out the clock and wait for the 2020 election or something like that? Yeah. So, okay.
No, I think that's right. That's let's table that discussion because I think that's a super interesting one. But I agree with you on that as well.
All right. Well, it's time to go back to the depressing topic of the wildfires. Wow, those are bad. Remember when my entire house was engulfed in smoke for what felt like a month? So we're going to find out maybe what happened there.
Yeah. So here's what we now know. Okay, we now have an awful lot of information, and we have it in a really interesting kind of way. We have it on the basis of an open case with case number 14-00175. And our more astute listeners, including you, are going, wait, doesn't that 14 from the beginning mean 2014? And in fact, it does.
Wow.
Do you know where San Bruno, California is?
Yeah, that's pretty close to me, I think. I think that's in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it's supposedly right outside the San Francisco airport.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay.
So Bay Area, outside the airport.
To me, it's all just one big area where houses cost $40 billion. Like, there's not...
Oh, yeah.
If you want to live there, you can't. That's all I know about it.
That is actually, I mean, let me do a little sidebar, right? I think this is still the case, but it was the dividing line when I was in law school, and people are kind of picking what cities they want to interview in, and then, you know, then potentially have a career, right? And I said, I mostly picked D.C. I interviewed with a couple firms in Chicago. I interviewed with one firm I really liked in L.A., one firm I liked in New York, although I was never really going to New York City. The dividing line was always between law students who wanted to go to San Francisco and everybody else. Because you would get together and you would sort of like compare, you know, average starting salaries in all of the various cities. And San Francisco was like the worst ratio in terms of lowest average starting salary and highest cost of living.
Right. The salaries are higher, but like when the other number is so high, the ratio gets really bad.
But I mean, compared to, right, like, so look, San Francisco salaries are high compared to Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
But compared to every other major legal city, they were, I think, dead last back when, yeah, when no, I
that,
was interviewed.
That sounds right.
You know.
So yeah, I'm curious. So the fire started in San Bruno in 2014, and then it spread all the way. How is this going to work out?
No. Well, so what happened? I don't know if you remember this. In September of 2010 in San Bruno, there was a pipeline, a steel natural gas pipeline that was owned by PG&E that exploded. Do you remember that?
Yeah. No, it was horrifying. Yeah.
It was something that initially first responders didn't know that a pipe had exploded. Eight people were killed. There was a, Wikipedia tells me, there was a 1,000-foot high wall of fire.
Yeah.
Which,
that's a lot.
Which, yeah, that sounds alternatively terrifying and awesome.
Yeah, right? Like what the height of wall of fire that you want is, but 1,000 is a lot.
So in connection with that, there was an investigation to figure out why the pipe exploded. And there were criminal proceedings that were brought against PG&E as a result of that explosion. And principally, those proceedings concerned a statute 49 U.S.C. 60123, which is the Natural Gas Pipeline Safety Act. And ultimately, U.S. attorneys brought a 12-count indictment against PG&E, one count of obstructing the investigation, which had to do with providing a misleading letter in connection with efforts to figure out what was going on with the pipeline, and then 11 counts that were based on a variety of things that led to the failure of the pipeline. I guess factually, I should say that ultimately what investigators determined was that the pipeline that exploded was welded together from a bunch of different pipes. And apparently this is not initially like when that broke, people were like, well, that seems suspicious. Are you just like recycling stuff in your pipeline? But apparently that's a fairly common process. The pipes were installed in 1956, and there were defects in the pipe that were not immediately detectable. There were no mechanisms to detect it in 1956, and the criminal lawsuit against PG&E was basically over whether from 1956 to 2010 they did adequate oversight, gathered the appropriate information, you know, were appropriately engaging in figuring out whether their pipes were safe.
This is something that once we get to Infrastructure Week, I hope we take a look at, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, you'd think. Oh, PG&E, by the way, I mean, you know this, but our listeners will not, is a state-chartered monopoly.
Yeah.
They are required to submit, to follow certain practices with respect to rate heights because they supply the electricity, and you know, that's it. So state-run monopoly. I should also add, in connection with this entire investigation, an independent audit from the state of California discovered in January of 2012 that PG&E had illegally diverted $100 million from a fund used for safety operations and used those for executive compensation and bonuses.
Wow.
So that's PG&E in 2010. An indictment was handed down in 2014, and it went to trial. There was a jury verdict in August of 2016. And let me do another kind of little sidebar. Right, we talk about the Mueller investigation and the wheels of justice grinding slowly and that sort of thing. This is true everywhere, right? It's not true only in the, you know, politically charged arena, right? This was an explosion in 2010. Charges were brought in early 2014. It went to verdict in late 2016, right?
Wow,
that's two and a half years. And that's fairly typical. You look at, I pulled the docket because I'm going to talk about that in a minute. There are almost 900 docket entries between the indictment being issued and trial because, you know, this is a billion-dollar company, and this is what high-stakes litigation, criminal litigation in this case, and as in the Mueller investigation, it's what it looks like. So again, another piece of ammunition just to keep in mind when, you know, your MAGA hat-wearing people are complaining that the Mueller investigation is just a two-year witch hunt. jury basically they convicted on six of the counts, and they acquitted on the other six. I'm not going to go count by count because it's really, you know, specific. They found guilty verdicts on the obstruction charge, 18 U.S.C. 1505. Put a pin in that one because you're going to see those charges come up again on Yodel Mountain, right? 18 U.S.C. 1505 is whoever corruptly endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the proper administration of the law by interfering with a pending proceeding. And they
Bookmarked that one.
Yep. Yeah. They determined that PG&E interfered with the investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board by sending a misleading memo, not turning over documents, other stuff.
Snapchat.
Yeah. there were no ostrich jackets. and then they found knowingly and willfully violated the Pipeline Safety Act. In a number of ways related to gathering the information regarding the safety of that particular pipeline. Threat identification, the baseline assessment plan, insufficient oversight of the manufacturing defects, and then and something involving an ERW, which is a low-frequency electric resistance welded pipe. I have no idea what that is. But put it all together, That's what happens, and so the jury returns a guilty verdict on six of the counts, and the government then had to determine, okay, we have a guilty corporation, we can't put the corporation in jail, so what do we want to do?
Can we stop them from compensating their executives $120 million or whatever you said that was?
You could. The U.S. Attorney's Office did not ask for that in this case, but put a pin in that question. That's a good one. Instead, what they asked for was the maximum statutory fine, right, which is $3 million. And then they said, look, $3 million is a drop in the bucket to PG&E. So what we want is we want a five-year probationary period, and we want that period to include monitoring of their safety procedures. We want it to include community service. We want them to have to run commercials. We want them to try and make restitution in the community. And they got that. The judge, I will upload the sentence, basically agreed with the government on all of those points and imposed a five-year probation period, which brings us to today, because that five-year probation period, we're in the middle of it. A probation for a company looks like probation for any kind of criminal
defendant.
Yeah,
don't start
right?
any forest fire. Ah, dang it.
Yeah.
Violated probation.
You have to, right. You have to report to your probation officer. This is, I'm 100% not making this up.
Is it like Smokey the Bear? Who's their probation?
They actually have, there is a retired judge who is the monitor for purposes of the monitoring program. There's a separate contact with the Department of Probation, and the first condition of PG&E was they had to designate one representative from the company to be the person that has to go talk to your PO. They are required to, you know, truthfully answer all the questions that the PO asks. Then there are specific requirements on only PG&E, right? And the principal one is, while on probation, PG&E shall not commit another federal, state, or local crime. So that brings us to today.
Which is a weird thing to say because, like, never commit another crime, like, regardless of probation. I don't know. What is...
Yeah, you'd think that.
Hey, listeners, you know what's not smart? Job sites that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through. That's not smart. And you know, oh my gosh, from my personal experience, back when I used to work for the state, we'd have to go through this very thing. Whenever we were hiring, you'd get a whole bunch of resumes and packets that were just people clicked on all of the available entries for where they were trying to apply. And so you'd get just a load of nonsense applications and resumes from people who had no business applying and just because they clicked a button. That's not smart. You know what is smart though? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/OA to hire the right person. Oh my gosh, I wish we could have done this back at the state. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply, so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. You know, hiring someone is a major decision, and you do not want to be stuck with a pool of candidates who you don't like, who aren't quite right for the job. Then you feel pressure to go with one. If it's the wrong candidate, then you're stuck with that person for so long. It is not worth it. Use ZipRecruiter. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA for opening arguments. One last time, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
So what's the additional punishment or something for committing a crime during this weird probation? That sounds like the concept behind a buddy comedy or something. We put PG&E on probation.
Right. And the answer is that when you have violated probation, the judge can go back to the original sentence and reopen that sentence and has broad discretion to fashion a new sentence and a new remedy for any violation of the act. And so if it sounds like I'm hedging my bets a little bit here, it's because I don't fully know what the court can do to a corporate defendant who violates probation, and neither does the court. And in fact, the court on November 27th of this year issued an order to the parties, including to the U.S. Attorney's Office and to PG&E, and it asked them four questions. And the first question that the court asks is, what requirements of the judgment herein, right, that's the probation, including the requirement against further federal, state, or local crime, might be implicated were any wildfire started by reckless operation or maintenance of PG&E power lines? So, in other words, the court would like to know, hey, if PG&E has any responsibility with the California wildfires, does that implicate this judgment? And both the U.S. Attorney's Office and PG&E have conceded, yes, it does. This absolutely, if PG&E is adjudged to have committed any crimes in connection with the California wildfires, that would violate the terms of the probation. It would let the court reopen it. And then the court can kind of do anything it wants with respect to PG&E in connection with that. Put a pin in that one, too, because I think that's going to come up again in a minute. In addition to asking the U.S. Attorney's Office and PG&E these sets of questions, I read you the first one. We'll get to the other three. The court did an interesting thing a couple of days later. And that interesting thing that they did a couple days later was file a supplemental inquiry to the California State Attorney General's office. And that supplemental inquiry filed on December 5th says, the court requests that the Office of the California Attorney General advise the court of its view on one aspect of this question, the one that I just read to you, namely the extent to which, if at all, the reckless operation or maintenance of PG&E power lines would constitute a crime under California law. So California AG's office then filed back an answer as an amicus brief to weigh in on that question. You want to take a guess at what the California AG's office said?
Well, you're leading me in here, so I'm going to guess that somehow it's just not even a crime or something, like, because you seem to be you're asking with one of those typical P. Andrew Esquire Torres smiles. So is it not even a crime or something?
I actually, the reason I was smiling is because I asked you a question you could not get wrong.
Oh, okay.
Here's
but
here's
I found a way to.
Yeah. The answer is yeah, you kind of did. Like,
we had no idea he could even find a way logically to get that wrong, but he did.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the Kobayashi.
I was going to say the same thing. We're brothers.
Oh, this is so great. Well, I think it's because we both watched William Shatner recently. So, yeah. Okay. So here's the answer, right? The state AG's office said, okay, you asked us if PG&E started a wildfire by its reckless operation or maintenance of its power lines, would that be a crime? The answer is it depends on the mental state of PG&E. At ordinary, and I'm, but I'm going to expressly kind of play this out because this is what the state says in its memo. At ordinary negligence, PG&E would not have committed any of the criminal offenses discussed in this brief. Okay, so ordinarily negligent, right? Well, you know, we failed to maintain this power line. It was downed. It started the fire. No crime. At criminal negligence, right? So slightly higher standard. PG&E would have committed involuntary manslaughter, starting a fire without permission and failing to keep its lines and poles clear of vegetation.
So this depends on if we find some emails that are like, hey, we really ought to do this. And then someone says, or something, you know, it just kind of depends on the motivation behind it or whatever.
Oh, wait, they continue.
Oh, okay.
At recklessness. So the difference now, the difference between recklessness and criminal negligence is whether there is conscious disregard of the risk. So you are 100% correct, right? What you would need is you would need some kind of memorandum that says, hey, this might happen and this would be a bad thing. And then you would need to prove conscious disregard of that. Yeah, but we're not going to do that. Go away. All right. Put a pin in that one, too. I know there are a lot of pins. We're doing this, you know, a beautiful mind thing again, but I want you to do that. Recklessness, PG&E could have committed the felony of unlawfully starting a fire. That's a more serious crime than involuntary manslaughter. And then here's the last line. At malice, PG&E could have committed murder.
Wow. Now,
what is malice, right? Fortunately, the brief tells us, even if you didn't have a lawyer on the line, right? You typically think of malice in the law as what is the subset of express malice, right? That is, I fly out to California, I show up on your doorstep, I pull out the knife I've carried with me all the way from Maryland, and I stab you through the brain, right? I intend to kill you.
Is this part of the show?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is all hypothetical.
After the break, we'll find out how that works out for Thomas. I don't know.
The AG's office rather dryly says, we do not understand the court's order to raise any question regarding an actual intent to kill.
You'd have to find a pretty bad document, as they say in the biz. You'd have to find, like, I'm tired of these citizens demanding power lines that work. I hate it. This power line will never work. I'm going to make sure it fails or something.
Well, I'm going to make sure it fails would not even meet the criteria of actual right. You would need a Monty
Burns
level.
You need Lex Luthor,
you
know, essentially.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you need
Montgomery
okay.
Burns saying, since the dawn of time, mankind has yearned to blot out the sun or set fire to the state of California, and with God as my witness, I shall do so. Okay, right. So not express explicit malice here, right? Implied malice, however, means that the circumstances of the killing show the actor's abandoned and malignant heart. And now, again, how do you have a malignant heart if you're a corporation, right? Other than, I guess, Blackwater, right? Unlike the criminal negligence part of the standard, corporate malice is defined as maintaining a subjective awareness of a higher degree of risk and an element of wantonness. Wantonness, in turn, meaning consciousness of one's conduct, intent to do or omit the act in question, and reckless disregard of the consequences. So, put all of that together. That means we have a sliding scale. We have four potential crimes, four potential criminal scenarios for PG&E. Scenario one, we were just negligent. We just screwed up. No harm, no foul, other than the state caught on fire. Scenario two, criminal negligence, higher degree of negligence. And if that's the case, then we have involuntary manslaughter. Third step up, recklessness, right? That is a conscious disregard of the risk. And then the fourth stage, recklessness plus all of the rest of the stuff, right? The intent to do or omit the act in question, an awareness of the higher degree of risk, and again, it's kind of a tough, bright line. But the California Attorney General's office said in a pleading, it is possible that this court may find PG&E guilty of murder.
Wow.
That strikes me as a pretty significant thing to say.
Yeah.
And it absolutely informs. And by the way, the California AG's office filed that 3 days before the U.S. government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and PG&E each concurrently filed their statements in asking, in answering the questions asked by the court. So absolutely, that filing influenced what the parties said here. So let's go back to the other things that the court asked. Remember, I said they asked four questions. The first was, what happens if they're guilty of a crime? And the answer is, judge, you can reopen this judgment. And who knows what you can do then. Question number two was, what requirements of the judgment might be implicated by any inaccurate, slow, or failed reporting of information about any wildfire by PG&E? That gives you some hint of what the judge is thinking about in terms of PG&E's culpability. Here, the significant answer is that PG&E concedes, if we were slow or inaccurate or failed to report any information in connection with the wildfire, that would violate multiple conditions of the probation. Conditions 2, 5, special conditions 1 and 8. And the government agreed with that. They also added that it could violate the monitoring condition. Question number 3 is where I got lost down the rabbit hole because I was initially surprised and then it made sense. And that question was, what specific steps has the monitor taken to monitor and improve PG&E's safety and reporting with respect to power lines and wildfires? And let's see if you're smarter than I am.
Spoiler, no.
Well, you have a 50-50 chance of being smarter than I was.
Of appearing to be smarter. Okay, cool.
Yes.
I'll take it. I'll take that chance.
What do you think the respective positions of the parties were, right, the U.S. Attorney's Office and PG&E, with respect to what the monitor has done in connection with this pipeline verdict from 2016 to monitor and report PG&E safety with respect to power lines and wildfires?
I have no earthly idea.
Well, once again, 50-50 chance of being smarter than me.
I don't see how this is a 50-50 chance. Like maybe it's because you're a lawyer reading this, but like, what? That sounds like an open, that's like an essay question. Yeah. And then you told me you have a 50, Thomas, 50-50, write an essay about what position they've taken on safety for the, like, what? I don't know.
Well, you're right. That's really funny that you say it that way, because that's exactly how I was breaking it down, right? Like, I was thinking in my mind, either they're going to say, yes,
they haven't done anything, or they have
has something to do with power lines, or
so is the question you're asking,
doesn't
like,
have a damn thing to do with power.
Right. Lines. Have they just over, as a result of the gas line explosion, have they even bothered with safety over power lines, or has it just been, you know, solely about ensuring the safety of other gas pipelines? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. Exactly. Right.
And what's the answer? I have no idea. I don't know. What's the answer?
So the answer is, PG&E's answer was, oh, yes, the monitor has been very, very active in taking a look at our power lines and our electrical safety, even though this was about a natural gas pipeline.
And are you confused because you would have thought they would say the opposite? Where they're like, well, no, they haven't really had any oversight on power lines, you know, in an attempt to try to mitigate the response. Is that what you're confused about?
In an attempt to do two things, right? Number one, in an attempt to get out, right, the investigations into the wildfires from coming under the probationary terms of a pipeline conviction, right? I on first blush, I thought, yeah, well, you would want to say those aren't related at all. And the second reason specifically I thought PG&E would minimize those contacts is because the more you say that PG&E has worked with a monitor to monitor the safety of its power lines and not just its pipelines, the more data you have and the easier, in my view, it is to fall within the ambit of the mental state required that we just went through with the California Attorney General's office, right? So in other words, the more we show, oh, okay, you knew about this, you knew about this, you knew about this, the easier it is to bring a potential criminal case that says you knew about it and then you didn't do anything, right? Which is the definition of criminal negligence and potentially the definition of recklessness. So that's what I expected. And what I discovered was, in fact, the exact opposite. That PG&E says, yeah, we work with the monitor all the time. And even though this was about pipeline, the monitor worked on an enterprise-wide level, including aspects of safety, such as safety culture, risk management, compliance, and ethics. On the other hand, the U.S. Attorney's Office says, of all of the enumerated goals of the monitor, defining the scope of the monitorship, all of them apply only to gas pipelines, not to power lines. The only thing in the monitor scope that applies here, that arguably applies here to power lines, is the ethics program. And so then I ask myself, why would they take that respective position? And it seems to me that what the U.S. Attorney's Office is trying to do here is to say, any activity by PG&E in connection with the California wildfires is going to be the subject of separate criminal action, cannot be argued to be under this existing case, and should not be treated as part of the broader implementation of the goals of the 2016 sentencing, and instead should be prosecuted separately. That tells me that they take this very, very seriously, right? I already read the bit about the California Attorney General's office saying in print, PG&E could be guilty of murder. And again, I don't think any of us think that that's particularly likely, but it's kind of astonishing that they would say that. And I think that explains, right? You know, I was sort of thinking of, you know, like The Fugitive or any of our, you know, legal movies that you've watched in which, you know, you have the feds are going to come in and take jurisdiction. Yeah. And this is my collar and all that. And that's, you know, that's TV. reality doesn't work that way, right? In reality, I think you have coordination here between the U.S. Attorney's Office and the California State AG's office that says, yeah, when it comes to the wildfires, we want you to go after PG&E.
We don't need Tommy Lee Jones to come in and say, search every outhouse, in-house, hen-house. Plus yeah, whatever. Exactly. But it's exactly. So great. I love it. I like that.
That is one of the all-time great monologues.
Ah, I love that movie.
Yeah, me too. So those are the answers to the question. Questions 1, 2, and 3. Question 4 is directed to PG&E and says, provide an accurate and complete statement of the role, if any, of PG&E in causing and reporting the recent campfire in Butte County and all other wildfires in California since the judgment therein. I need to tell you, this answer, right, the narrative section is 12 pages long. The attachments are 390 pages in length and spread across 35 different downloads. And as PG&E says, quote, because of the volume of these materials, PG&E has not submitted to the court all of the reports that it has made. We do, however, provide examples of these reports for the court's review. So, look, we could do a month on just what PG&E says. But fortunately, I have read the 390 pages, so you don't have to.
Wow.
And I will tell you the key admission that it says. And as far as I
you
know,
skimmed it. That's you've got better stuff to do.
As far as I know, nobody else has picked up on this other than
okay,
I am
maybe
sure
not. Maybe you don't have better stuff. All right, give us the scoop.
Plaintiff's lawyers probably have found this as well, but I haven't seen any reports in the public media about the admission that is in PG&E's Attachment A. I'm going to upload it to the show notes. Here's what they say. On November, so the campfire starts on November 8th at 6 in the morning. There's a whole lot of circumstantial stuff that is interesting, but doesn't get us to criminal liability because, you know, remember, if there's just ordinary negligence, California Attorney General has said, not going to do anything about that. This is, and there is, right? The line goes down. There's a truck on fire. There's a whole bunch of reports by PG&E officials. The question is there something more than that? And the way in which there would be something more than that is prior to November 8th, if PG&E noticed something,
right,
and didn't do anything about it.
That's what I was saying about the emails or something. There's going to be like a, oh, I noticed there's a, there's like a sparking line next to a can labeled jet fuel. Should we do anything about that? That kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of like that. So on November 14th, 6 days after the fire, CAL FIRE, right, the state agency that investigates into wildfires, asks PG&E about a tower, and I don't understand this at all. I'm going to call this Tower 27, but the designation is Tower colon 27 slash 222.
Huh.
I don't know. I can't begin to
figure out. It's
like
the tower's IP address or something.
Right. It is. So
log into this tower.
So they ask about this Tower 27. And then it says, at the time of the collection at Tower 27, PG&E observed a broken C-hook, right, kind of connector, that had attached the suspension insulator to a tower arm, along with wear at the connection point, right? So really clearly, broken connector that attaches this suspension insulator to the tower. And a flash mark on Tower 27 where the jumper was suspended and damage to the transposition jumper and suspension insulator. Okay, so that seems pretty clear to me, right? The C-bolt, this C-hook, I should call it, that is holding up the insulation, wears down, breaks, the arm smashes down, there's a spark, and there's a flash mark, right, on the tower, and that starts the fire at this particular location. Addition, there was an insulator hold down anchor that had become disconnected, all related to this broken hook. Buried in Exhibit A, you can find it, is the following sentence. PG&E's understanding, based upon its records, which means, by the way, the email that you predicted, is that during the most recent routine aerial patrol of the line, right, that is the line going to Tower 27, in September of 2018, a new finding was reported for Tower 27 because an insulator hold-down anchor's turnbuckle, right, that's the C connection, had become disconnected.
Jump off of it. Sorry, go ahead. That's where you go. Sorry, no, that's...
Yeah,
that's where you do Starry Decisis from the top rope. Yeah, okay, got it. I'm picturing it, okay. Yeah.
So that insulator hold down anchor's turnbuckle had become disconnected, required repair. This is the same issue that was identified during CAL FIRE's November 14th collection of evidence. As noted above, an insulator hold down anchor is not an energized piece of equipment. Okay, that's their attempt of saying that the clamp itself is not energized, does not have power flowing through it. So what? Right. As a result of the September 2018 aerial patrol, a notification was created to repair the insulator hold-down anchor within 12 months.
Okay.
That notification was open at the time of the campfire in November 2018. So, in other words, the direct piece of evidence here is that 2 months before the campfire, there was an aerial flyby. They noticed that this turnbuckle had become disconnected. They said, hey, you got to fix it. PG&E said, okay, well, we'll fix that within a year. 2 months went by. They did not fix it. That C clamp buckled and ruptured.
That's interesting, you know, because I was going to say that early on. I was like, if this was something that was kind of on their maintenance list, you know, I wonder what it's not like that. That doesn't sound criminal to me. I mean, wouldn't their defense just be, look, we can't, if we had the resources to fix everything the second we found it, then sure. But like, you know, how reasonable is the expectation that they should fix things within a certain period of time?
And that you've asked exactly the right question. Let's go back to our standards of criminal intent here, right? Which begin with, if this is just ordinary negligence, right? If you just screwed up, we should have done repairs, but we didn't do the repairs. There's no criminal behavior. The question is, was there a particular risk that you knew about that you failed to act on,
right,
and then failed to act with the greater degrees of culpability? And what that's going to turn on is the standard of care, right? And so PG&E is going to introduce experts that say, no, look, like, this is standard practice in the industry.
Yeah.
When you see that the turnbuckle's out, right, that's not likely to cause a problem. It's not foreseeable that it's going to cause this kind of problem. It's reasonable to want to replace it within a year. We did everything that was that was required of us to do that was reasonable. There are pending, I alluded to plaintiff's lawyers, there are many, many pending private plaintiff lawsuits against PG&E, as you might imagine.
Basic question. Is this all under the idea of are they liable or have they violated their weird probation thing? Or is this just now we're in the territory of just forget all that, regardless whose fault is this? And we're kind of adjudicating that.
Well, it's both.
It's
right?
Both.
So
okay.
The civil lawsuits, right, have, you don't have to show, you know, wanton and willful disregard. You just have to show, was PG&E responsible for the wildfires, right? And was this a reasonably foreseeable consequence of PG&E's actions? So if PG&E, we might even add that as a step zero, right? Like we've said, if they've committed ordinary negligence, then there's no criminal behavior. If they've committed ordinary negligence, they will nevertheless have to pay out billions of dollars to plaintiffs for having caused the wildfires.
Jeez.
Right. So the question,
how is it even negligence? If it's like, we noticed it, it's on our list, we were going to repair it within a certain amount of time. Is that negligent? Like, so is the expectation that you, everything should be perfect all the time?
No, the question is, what's the appropriate standard of care to remedy that situation? So let me give you an obvious and ridiculous example, right? I tie the sword of Damocles above your head, right? that is being held by a rope that has frayed to the point where there is a single thread ready to fall.
Sounds reasonable to me.
And you're in the chair,
yeah,
right? Well, there.
Tune in after the break to find out how to.
yeah, this has been a particularly violent episode for you. There, right? My standard of care is to replace that immediately, right? Like I look at it and I go, "Oh gosh, this rope is about to fall at any moment, and the sword will kill Thomas." If I suspend just the sword on the rope above your head, then the question is. Right. At some point, it's probably going to fray. But then the question is, what do I know? And what is the standard in the industry for when ropes are likely to fray? And did I act in reasonable performance of my duty to replace the rope before it frayed and the sword?
Googling
fell and
sword of Damocles industry standards and practices.
Yeah, this is where expert witnesses are going to come in. So look, that's
we
what
got
this
Damocles
is going
himself.
To come down to.
Damocles, would you come to the?
but that's what this is going to come down to, right? Is when you notice this in September, right? Is this something that you should have acted on immediately and should have said, oh my gosh, like this is a clamp and this part of the structure could come loose. And if it comes loose, that could be catastrophic. Or is it not?
It just kind of depends on what the norms are. or regulations?
Yeah,
it
does. Okay. I will tell you, I mean, in sort of thinking about it, right, the fact that there were stress marks on the C clamp, right? I don't know. I mean, I'm not particularly mechanically oriented, to put it very, very mildly. I'm sure we have listeners who are. I did some quick Googling after, you know, reading all of this to try and figure out how often C hooks fail, and I couldn't come up with something. This is why you hire an expert.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's metal wear at the connection point, that to me, I don't know. As a lawyer, if I were PG&E's lawyer and they came to me and said these are the facts, like, I would go, well, that seems like a bad fact. Right? that would be the first thing that I would say with respect to it. Well, like,
yeah.
How often does metal wear like that?
I imagine it might turn on a little bit is like, well, if later on you come to find out, well, in the state of California, there's 8 billion of these things and like 40% of them are this bad all the time. You know, like, that's what I would wonder. How is this just part of a long list of, you know, okay, these are risky, but, you know, we're getting to them in a reasonable amount of time? Or is the, like, relative to the normal state of affairs, how bad is this particular C hook from which you can leap and yell Starry Decisis from the top rope, brother?
I think that, to me, this is the best way to wrap up the discussion, because you have analyzed that 100% perfectly. That's exactly what this is going to come down to. I certainly think it's interesting that, as far as I can tell, the entirety of the California of the campfire, I should say, and there's a second site, yeah. And you know that there's I don't want to be oversimplifying more than this, but I do want to simplify that that the entirety of the criminal and certainly the civil activity here may come down to this one clamp at a PG&E tower in California. So
wow.
So there you go.
Yeah. Well, and we're out of time, but I would subsequently later on, maybe I'm curious how much, you know, Republican led climate change, you know, how much are they responsible for the fact that in November or whatever, the weather is, it's like a hot summer's day, a dry hot summer's day in California, you know, is that going to mitigate their liability? But lots of, we're already way over. So interesting. That was a very good in-depth deep dive. Andrew read a 300 and whatever 70 page or 20 page, whatever he said, document, so you didn't have to. And thanks, Andrew. Cool breakdown.
Yeah.
All right. It is time to thank our top patrons over at patreon.com/law. And we begin with Quantum Trump is both impeached and unimpeached until observed. Sure. Great. Casual Springsteen fan. Yep. No, I was wrong. Thomas was wrong. Thomas and Andrew were wrong. An overworked Coke dealer on Pennsylvania Avenue. Stormy McKendrick. A 15-letter word with no letters repeated is uncopyrightable. Huh. This one tricky trick to trap treasonous Trump tomorrow. Monica. Started 2018 with one government, ended it with zero. John Bilderback. Unintelligible real property question. Yep. I'm about due for one of those just to really get my bad streak going further. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. McKinney ISD does not respect the First Amendment. Watch William Shatner's new road trip show, Shat in the Driver's Seat. The Registry Matters podcast. Advocate for a foster child in your community, CasaForChildren.org. DataHack.com, business automation, making the menial automatic. I love that URL. It's great. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Burbank Makerspace, Blank Boxman. Random chance seems to have operated in our favor. Kurt Robinson, Yodely McYodelface. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Thank you. Trump the plump grump fell on a frump stump and got a dumped lump. I'm trapped in a Patreon factory. Please send help. Michael Cohen is a no-talent ass clown. Why should I change my name? He's the one who sucks. Oh, great movie. Sam Buck. Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Cosmo got Thomas to talk Springsteen for 5 whole minutes blues. Yeah, well, there you go. I did, and you got me to say things that were objectively wrong. Chris Rowden, join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Mike the Intactivist, Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU3L. The Getting Off Podcast. James, I invented a new word, plagiarism. When I said, try me, bro, I did not mean in court. Polly Chuck, Donald Trump's insane clown horde posse. chain of custody. Rob Schreck, Dalen Lee Samus Gricks, batting 0.5 on TTTBE, but 0.8 laughing, but over 0.8 laughing at my name. Fart joke. Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison, and Anonymous. Thank you guys so much, and take it away, Andrew.
Yeah, and thank you to Buttercup's Legal Services. Wishes you a purry new year at 831-CAT-LAW-1. I got to give them a call. Welcoming the newest OA listener, Baby Wendy. Aw. Never mind, you can keep Eric Carlson.
Ooh, well, hey, that you need to update that because he is killing it now.
Zabby, vote democratically for a Democrat to preserve democracy. Discover truly marvelous name, margin too narrow to contain. If I could save this chord progression in a bottle. Springsteen's appearance on Boston Legal, where he played Stairway. Oh, that's fantastic.
Is that real?
There was never such a thing. They're just kind of merging together.
I don't know. Apparently there's a Boston Legal where James Spader is at the Supreme Court. So what am I to believe? In the first episode we covered on Lamb, Al Sharpton popped out like the Kool-Aid man and gave a speech. Am I so off base for wondering whether this really happened? I don't know.
Could be. All right. Not so much a defense, more a plea of YOLO, contender A. WordOrigins.org. Novation. Latin novitio is from Justinian, not 13th century Saxony. Derek. Saul. Goklahoma. Okay. Enrage moping nuts is an anagram of opening arguments. Nice. Rap battle of P. Law Dog Torres versus Pauly M. Fort. A string of unpronounceable characters. Big easy blasphemy. Mourning the slaughter of the lovably flawed Boston Legal a-holes. Denny Crane is my favorite lawyer. Alan Shore is a close second. Brandon Smith. Thanos is my favorite intergalactic supervillain. Andrew is a close second. Rhonda is wearing her amicus briefs. Nice. Good for you, Rhonda. Soggy Pants. CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Malika Chandler. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Abacus Flinch. Sam Danow. Hedonism Bot. Oh, awesome. Greg Sullivan. Sex bots should be called compubines. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Matthew Vernon, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Aaron Grady. Cheers to 2019. Well, cheers to you too. St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers, Ian and Allie, Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, Descartes the pig says, I think, therefore I ham. Andrew is my favorite musician. Thomas is a close second. Oh, that's nice. Funny. Way to turn the tables there. Used Carl salesman, Mormon J. Fox Esquire. And of course, our number one, our top Hall of Famer, the apex of the pyramid, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels. Thank you so much.
All right, good stuff. And now it's time for me to continue losing on the bar exam. I'm hoping to keep my 50%. Got a long way to go to lose it, but it can be done. Let's see.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Yeah, well, and with that cheerfully joyous introduction.
I'm on a bad run. I'm on a bad run.
You are on a bad run, but I feel like today is the day that we bust that slump.
So YOLO contendere. Here we go.
YOLO contendere. A man bought an antique car from a car dealer in state.
Carl dealer, where it's all one universe.
Under state A law, a person who buys from such a dealer acquires good title, even if the property was stolen from a previous owner. Interesting law. The man showed the car at an antique car show in state B. A woman recognized the car as having been stolen from her.
Oh,
under state B law, a person whose property is stolen may reclaim it, even if the current possessor is an innocent purchaser. The woman sued the man in state B court.
State
to reclaim
C
the car.
Is the purge state. So what happened?
A train in state C is hurtling towards trade B. Must be totally serious here.
Yes.
So the woman sues the man in state B court to reclaim the car. In his defense, the man claimed that he had good title under the law of state A. Nevertheless, the state B court applied state B law and the woman prevailed. The man did not appeal.
Huh.
The sheriff had the car returned to state B and gave the woman possession of the car. Several months later, the woman moved to state A, bringing the car with her. The man brought a new suit against the woman in state A court, claiming that the state B court in the prior suit should have applied the state A law, which protects innocent purchasers. The woman appeared and moved to dismiss the suit. What should state A do? What should the state A court do? All right.
Find a better name.
A. Yeah. Apply the federal law of the sale of goods because the car has moved in interstate commerce. B. Apply state A law because the car is currently located in state A. C. Dismiss the suit because the state A court must give full faith and credit to the state B judgment.
Ah.
Or D. Remove the case to federal court because the car has moved in interstate commerce and therefore the case raises a federal question.
Oh, okay. I love how you say I have a good feeling about this one. You say that every time. It doesn't matter that it's the most complicated.
Yeah, well, that was before I read the question.
Good to know that's not based on an actual reading of the question. But that's, you know, that's how we run it here. You don't play favorites. Okay. I think I know the answer to this one. I think. I hope I'm right, but I don't. This is tough. You know, I'm not going to go back through this whole absurd fact pattern. You got state A law, you got state B law, et cetera, et cetera. Here's what I think the key is. The lawsuit, the man brought. So, you know, obviously the woman in state B moves to state A, and then that's foolish thing to do. Go to any other state. Anyway, several months later, the woman moves to state A, brings the car with her. The man brought a new suit. But this is what's interesting to me. A new suit against the woman in state A court claiming that the state B court in the prior suit should have applied the state A law, which protects innocent purchasers. So what seems weird to me about that is when you bring a new suit saying, hey, like, I don't know how realistic this would be. Like in California, you bring a lawsuit saying a Nevada lawsuit was Nevada case was wrong because they should have used California law. Like that seems weird to me. However, I mean, I do know that you've talked about in the past about using Texas, this one weird Texas law to decide whether or not the Stormy Daniels thing, something or other. So I guess sometimes you can apply another state law. But that it doesn't seem right to me, and I'm leaning toward a certain answer. So let's see. Apply the federal law of sale of goods because the car has moved in interstate commerce. All right. I think A seems nonsensical to me, but I don't know. I mean, I could be like, yes, it has moved in interstate commerce, but what would you apply a federal law of sale of goods to? Like the answer is what the court should do in response to the guy bringing a new suit. So A can't be right, or I just shouldn't. Whatever, I'm not a lawyer. B, apply state A law because the car is currently located in state A. I guess B. I mean, that's plausible. I could be an answer. C, dismiss the suit because state A court must give full faith and credit to state B judgment. That's the one I'm leaning toward. Because I don't think you can have state A court question and review a state B court decision. That doesn't make any sense to me. Otherwise, that would be endless. It would just be courts doing that to each other all the time. So I'm really leaning towards state C. Answer C. Answer D. Remove the case to federal court because the car has moved in interstate commerce and therefore the car... the case raises federal question. I mean, that could also be true, but not the way this... Okay, I'm going with C. That's the one I think is the best because I think the way that the guy filed this lawsuit, which is to say the man brought a new suit claiming that the state B court should have applied state A law, it sounds like he's trying to get state A to overturn a state B court case, which to me, I just do not think that's how it works. And I think that C dismissed the suit because state A must give full faith and credit to state B judgment. That one to me really seems like the answer. And I'm going with C.
All right. Well, if you want to play along with Thomas on TTTB, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media, include your answer, include the reasons therefore, the hashtag TTTBE, and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
Whew. All right. Let's hope I got back on that saddle or whatever, because this has been a bad streak.
Are you on a saddle?
In a saddle. Well, see, I don't want to actually ride a horse. So my saddle is like it's a giant room that I sit in while my horse goes. So I'm back in the saddle. Anyway, thank you for listening. That was a really interesting breakdown on PG&E for sure. That is, let's put that corporation in probation or whatever. It's bizarre. But good old fashioned OA deep dive. I love it. So keep yodeling. Happy oversight day, and we will see you folks on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.